And the first thing on our agenda is a report from the Citizens for Election Integrity. I think we've got a number of people who wish to testify, so if they'd like to come up and... Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Mark Halverson. I'm the Director of Citizens for Election Integrity, and I'm one of the co-chairs, along with Mysore, of the Voting Machine Options Working Group. Representative Pawlowski and committee members, good morning.
Mr. Halverson, excuse me, if you could just give us some background as to where the report came from and why it's before us, that would be helpful.
Certainly. If I could direct your attention to Appendix 1, we have excerpted the law that was passed a year ago, which establishes a working group to investigate and recommend the legislature requirements for additional options for voting equipment that complies with the requirements of Section 301 of the Help America Vote Act. And the group was grew out of concerns between some of the counties that have the Diebold optical scan machines, and they were concerned that the AutoMark, which was certified by the Secretary of State's office, was not compatible with the Diebold marking, the Diebold optical scan machines, and wanted to explore other possible options. So the working group was conceived as another vehicle to look at non-AutoMark ballot marking devices. And the group met four times, and as you can see from Appendix 2, there was a great diversity in the group representing election officials, legislators, citizen groups, disability groups, and the political parties. We covered two areas. One, the primary focus was developing and distributing the AutoMark surveys, and MyThor will discuss those. And then we also investigated some other ballot marking devices, and Steve Jacobson is going to be talking a little bit more about those. Besides the AutoMark, there are only two other ballot marking devices that meet Minnesota law and are compatible with our optical scan voting machines. And these are the vote pad and the vote by phone. Unfortunately, the group found neither of these devices to be viable. In December of 2005, our organization, along with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, we hosted a mock election for the general public, in particular for members of the disability community, to try out the vote pad, which is a non-electronic ballot marking device. And while many of us initially found it an intriguing option, and we were hoping it might provide an alternative, especially for the four Diebold counties, an alternative to the AutoMark, there were several concerns that were raised about its functioning and the cost, and the group does not endorse this device. The other device that we looked at briefly is called the Vote by Phone. The working group was also concerned about the ability of the vote by phone device to accommodate people who are deaf, hard of hearing, and the potential challenge for some polling places to provide a phone and a fax machine. In brief, the working group recommends that we continue to use the AutoMark through the 2008 elections. The working group is willing to reconvene if directed to do so to assess ballot marking devices as they become available in the future. And as co-chairs, Mai and I would recommend, if the group is to continue, that it be convened by the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you. Ms. Thor, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mai Thor, and I am an advocate with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. working as co-chair, as Mark had mentioned, with the working group. I'm just going to give you a quick summary of the AutoMark survey that the group put together. The results are not within the information that you got, but as indicated in the report, you can, you know, certainly go to the League of Women Voters website, and the link is cited in the report here if you would like to look at that. It's kind of long, so we didn't want all of you to have to look through all of it. So the AutoMark survey was developed by the group early on when we first began meeting last summer. There were three target audiences that we wanted to reach, which were voters, election judges, and election administrators. So we tailored each survey according to those audiences. And the reason for the survey was basically because, you know, we felt that it was needed to really get a good feel and an evaluation of how the AutoMark actually would perform during the elections. So we had a survey during the primaries and a survey during the general elections as well. For the primaries, we had over 100 people, a little over 100 people respond to our survey. The results were generally pretty positive, and voters who used it felt that it was easy to use and it allowed them to vote independently and privately. Responses from election judges varied, and many said that they had to give assistance to voters who used the AutoMark, but didn't really report any other kinds of major problems. And it was pretty much the same with the election administrators as well. Lots of time was spent on programming, but overall no big issues. For the general elections, there was about approximately 320 people who responded to the survey. 70 of this were voters, 50 were election administrators, and 200 were election judges. Voters indicated that they knew about the machine beforehand through either a service provider that they are affiliated with or through their elections office. Most thought, again, that it was easy to use and provided privacy and independence on a certain level, if not fully. Performance of the machine was slow, which was sort of the general consensus of everybody who used the AutoMark in one way or another. And in some cases, it did malfunction or it didn't work at all. Average time was about 10 to 15 minutes, and voters stressed the need to continue to train election judges more. Of the 50 responses from election administrators, 20 indicated that they had to replace their machine due to malfunction. More hands-on training would be helpful for election judges, and some indicated that little training was actually provided for them. There were issues with programming again. Programming took a long time, long hours, and extra staff. And there were just other problems, and we can certainly go into detail with those a little bit later if you would like, but just some technical issues like the ballots not being fed correctly into the machine and things like that. And finally, election judges, the comments from them just was basically the same from the primaries. Several voters, according to the election judges, thought that the machine was an actual ballot counter and tried to put their ballot into the machine at the end where it counts it up because of where it was positioned, or maybe the election judges just didn't direct the voters correctly when they finished filling out their ballot. A few people felt that the machine was a waste of time and a waste of money because nobody used it. Elderly voters had a lot of trouble with it. Lots of election judges indicated that they were so busy at their polling places that they just had no time to do anything with the machine or help anyone with it. And a lot of people, I would say the majority of the election judges who responded to the survey said that most voters didn't know anything about it or did not use it. So in total, there were about 400 people who responded to the survey.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson, do you wish to testify? Welcome to the committee and identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Steve Jacobson. I am at 5805 Kellogg Avenue in Edina, and I'm a resident of District 41A. Thank you for allowing time from your busy schedules to hear my comments this morning. For more than 4 years, I've been following the development of accessible voting throughout the United States, partly as my role as Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind in Computer Science, but also as a computer analyst with an interest in technology. Therefore, when this issue became important here in Minnesota, I think I attended pretty much every demonstration that took place of accessible voting machines. I am grateful to be allowed to attempt to represent the perspective of blind voters while also bringing my knowledge of computer technology into the mix as part of this work group. During this past year, I was able to vote for the first time with complete privacy. I not only voted for the first time, but I took advantage of both chances by voting in the primary and the general election. This was, of course, not the first time that I voted. Emotionally, though, it was like voting for the first time, because I didn't wonder if my vote was cast as I had intended. I could even skip some of the judges without feeling guilty. To be very honest, I did not expect that the emotional impact that this experience had on me. One of my friends in the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota suggested that maybe it's similar to the experience of a naturalized citizen when he or she votes for the first time. I don't know, but I do want to thank you, both the past and the current secretaries of state, and the many election judges and poll workers who made this experience possible. This is new technology, and it brings with it new challenges. Even with some of the minor difficulties we experienced here in Minnesota, things went very smoothly here compared with some of the other areas of the country. Even so, the need to cut costs is always present, and all options must continually be examined. A number of people, including me, examined closely the vote pad, which was a relatively inexpensive approach. Our experiences are covered in our report, but I assure you that we attempted to consider that approach with an open mind. Besides being cumbersome and time-consuming, much more so than the automark, as Mai mentioned, there were many questions for which there were no answers, at least at the time that we were considering the vote pad, that involved both cost and auditing. We also know that there are issues and needs to be resolved with respect to townships, and I believe there is common ground that can be found if we can gain a better understanding of all perspectives. I believe also that there are alternatives and a deep interest as well as a commitment to find something with which we can all live there. There will likely be states moving into a paper ballot system, judging from the mood of the country. This should increase our options and perhaps even bring down the costs in time. Additionally, these accessible voting machines will not always be seen as machines for the blind, as they are often seen today, but will become an everyday part of voting for many people, even those who may not consider themselves disabled. Grandma Johnson, who is embarrassed because she can no longer hold a pencil steady and always has something else to do on election day, may find the touch screen on some of these machines to make her life a little bit simpler for voting and might just start voting again. Grandpa Smith, who says he only needs glasses but is not blind, but who also is always busy on election day, may find the higher contrast and color choices will make his voting experience fun again. Our job is not done as voters or as legislators, but we are off to a good start, and I really think the future is bright. Again, I very much appreciate everyone who has helped give me and the rest of us the chance to vote, as everyone else does, in complete privacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Representative Hilty and Representative Emmer were also on the task force. So if Representative Hilty, if you'd like to say anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on the task force and actually was a participant in forming it in the first place. But I don't really think there's a whole lot to add to this testimony. I think that the report very adequately reflects the conclusions that the group drew. And I particularly appreciate Mr. Jacobson's perspective on this. He's been a valuable participant in discussions all along, and I think that what he said pretty much sums it up.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Can we get a description of exactly what you can expect with the Automark machine if you were to come in? What would you see and experience, and what?
Mr. Halverson, or who would be the best to answer that question?
I'll just say a few words and let my say more. The Automark has been mischaracterized by some of the media. It's not an electronic voting machine. It's an electronic ballot marking device. So if I were to use it, I would just use the touch screen. The device actually marks the ballot, and then it spits it out, and then I take my ballot, and it's read by the optical scan machine. So it only marks the ballot. It doesn't tabulate the ballot. So I wanted to make that distinction first of all. And then Mike can talk about there's a lot of features that make it accessible for the disabled community, and I'll let Mike talk about that.
Ms. Starr, why don't we let her respond, and then I'll go to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you're a voter and you're going to go vote on Election Day, you go to your polling place, and there should be one of these machines at every polling place in Minnesota. So if there wasn't one, let me know. Ideally, the Automark is supposed to be accessible, however, also providing privacy. And so the machine, as Mark indicated, is a touchscreen machine. The expectation was that it would be marketed to the public as sort of an electronic pen, where individuals who had difficulty holding a pen and marking your ballot the traditional way could use this machine despite disability or not. And so the machine should be in a private area in your polling place, not facing the rest of the voters as they come in, but maybe facing towards a wall or in a little area where it's more private and secure. And the election judge ideally would offer the Automark to all voters, and just say, hey, there's this new machine. Would you be interested in using it? The voter has a choice in whether they want to use it or not. And they would just go up to the machine, and the election judge, being trained in on this machine, would be able to explain to the voter how to use it. The machine itself has many features for individuals who may have had or may not. The machine does come with a touch screen, much like an ATM machine. So you would just, go through each screen by touching the choices that you want for each race. It also comes with a keypad option, and throughout this whole time it does have audio. So you could listen to the audio, use the touch screen, or the keypad. The keypad does come with Braille as well. The audio, is just kind of prompting the voter throughout the entire ballot, what to do and what the races are and who the candidates are. The ballot is the exact same ballot that everybody else uses in their precinct, so that that was a great advantage to using this machine, so that there was no, difference between who used the Automark and who didn't. The voter also has many other options that they could use with this machine, as far as making the print larger on the screen, if that would help. If the person has low vision, they could read the actual words better if the letters were larger. They could also just shut off the screen if they didn't want, maybe people walking by to see what was on the ballot. There would be no use for it anyway if you had no vision. You just go through the audio. And there are other features. Maybe Steve wants to talk a little bit more about it because he has more experience with it. But it really does provide a lot of good options for people with different kinds of disabilities. My understanding is that there was also an option to use a sip and puff tube if you needed that as well. I never actually saw it in use, but that was a feature that came with the AutoMark. So I think it really did work very well for a lot of people. And the only negative thing, I think, was which came up consistently was the fact that it was kind of slow and it was pretty heavy. So hopefully in the future those things will be improved.
Mr. Jacobson?
Just one real brief comment. I wanted to comment on the time. Probably because I and a number of us are familiar with technology, the time may not have, that we took to vote may not have been as large an issue as it was for some people that responded to the survey. But I do think it's worth pointing out that comparing the AutoMark with how one of you would vote, it would definitely be somewhat slower. But in my case, you need to keep in mind that my alternative would probably be to use someone else to do the same reading. And in theory, I would have the right to request that two election judges do that, so that when I used the AutoMark, I didn't feel it took me any longer than it would have to read, and there were two election judges who were not tied up helping me. And so I think that needs to be kept in mind. But also, as people get more experience, I don't think the timing is going to be as big an issue as it may have seemed to be in the first usage.
Mr. I have a one-page summary from the vendor's website. If you'd like, I'd be happy to pass around.
You want to give it to the page, they'll pass around. Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to underscore something that Mr. Halverson omitted in his initial description, but Ms. Thor did touch on, and that is, I think, one of the really important features of this device is that it does use the same ballot that every other voter uses. So you initiate the use of the machine just by taking a regular ballot and inserting it in the machine, and all the machine actually does is make the marks on the ballot.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jacobson, did it give you a verification and an audio verification of how your ballot was marked so you knew for sure that it marked it properly?
Mr. Jacobson.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it did it in two different ways. As you go through, you press arrow keys to move up and down through the list of candidates for each election, and you press another button and it would tell you selected. You use a left and right arrow to move from election to election. In the case of elections where you choose more than one, you are informed if you undervoted or if you overvoted. It lets you know that as you go through. And then at the end, there is a ballot summary that lets you again hear what you chose before printing the ballot. And then once it prints the ballot, of course, you bring it over to the scanner, or in theory, it could be counted manually for that matter. So yes, there's the two levels of summary, and it's all done with audio, and generally speaking, you'd use it with a pair of headphones, obviously.
Any further questions?
Sure.
Representative.
As I heard you go through it, I mean, I heard that some of the, you said, Mr. Jacobson, you said some challenges that were there, but some of the stuff I heard through your presentation, that the seniors were having problems, that it was slow, as you explained, which in your case, you didn't think it was any slower than what would be otherwise. Elderly had trouble, and I heard training, people filming with machines because they were new, the judges feeling they didn't have enough training. I think these are all things we can overcome. I think the seniors having challenges with, and elderly having challenges with technology is something we all face, and any of us that have kids know that our kids do technology a whole lot better, and if we have trouble with our machines, that those are the ones we have to ask. So I think that most of the challenges I hear, I think things we can overcome with proper training and more training.
Representative Brott, I'm sorry.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just encourage, actually, the members of the committee to go try this thing out. It is pretty cool. It is pretty cool. I actually used it myself just to try it out and see how it functions, see how it worked. And if you have your hands on it and get a sense of it, I would really encourage the members of this committee to find a way to do that. I think that there's a number of opportunities, and maybe, Ms. Thor, you can indicate when those might be, but I would really encourage the committee to go do that.
Ms. Thor.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I first wanted to respond to Representative Nelson's comment. As far as the training goes, that was one of our recommendations within our report, and when we had our final meeting, we talked about this at length, and it turns out that after that, we've continued to have discussions with the Secretary of State staff, and so that is something that we're going to continue to put emphasis on before between now and the 08 elections. And so definitely the outreach and the training will continue and maybe be developed in a different way where even more election judges and more voters will understand how to use this machine better. As to Representative Broad's comments, if anybody's free today at 3 o'clock, we'll be giving our report to the Senate, and we will actually have an automark there at the hearing. So if you're curious about it, please stop by over at the Senate side, and we'll be glad to do a demonstration for you. But otherwise, you know, your local county elections offices and city clerk offices should have a machine on hand. You know, anytime, feel free to stop by, and I'm sure that they'd be happy to help you with it and maybe go through using the machine with you.
Ms. Thor, does the Secretary of State's office keep a demonstration of this in their office?
I believe they do, yes.
All right. Thank you. That would be easier for us than to go to the Senate. But that's okay. Any other questions? No. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much. And I want to thank Representative Hilty and Representative Emmer also for serving on the task force. It's greatly appreciated. The next item on the agenda is House File 340. Representative Slawick, I saw her come in. There she is. We've got a Representative Slawick, welcome to the committee, and I think what we'll do first is get your bill before us. So, Representative Morgan?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move HF 340, and I believe it's going to General Register, is that right?
I believe so, General Register.
Yes.
And then, Representative Slawick, you have a delete all amendment, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I do. HO 340DE2.
And Representative Morgan, do you want to move that amendment?
I'll move the delete all amendment.
And members, I believe, Representative Morgan, there's a correction on lines 1.12.
There must be.
All right. Representative Morgan, I'm sure would be saying this.
Yes, on line 1.12, it should... For candidate registering voters, not registering votes. So
Representative Morgan incorporates that into the motion of the delete everything amendment, that we correct the word vote should be corrected to voters. And with that, Representative Slawick, please identify yourself for the record and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Nora Slawick, State Representative, 55B, Oakdale and Maplewood. Thank you for the opportunity to hear this bill here today. This is really just a very simple little bill. It amends 211B, and where this came from is Senator Pappas and I, last session, worked on a similar bill where to clarify that folks are allowed to come into multiple unit facilities. as that is mentioned here. Then what happened during the last campaign, there was an issue around folks leaving campaign materials. So the basic thrust of this bill, what we really want to add into it, is that folks are permitted to leave campaign materials once they're in the facilities. I do have Jack Horner with me today, who can also speak in favor of the bill.
Mr. Horner, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Mr. Chairman and members, we think it's a good bill. We've worked with Representative Slough. We very much appreciate the work that we've done and that the accommodation she's made to a couple of concerns that we had. But we do certainly support the bill, and I'd be willing to stand for any questions that the members may have.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slough, I'm concerned about what 204B.09 leaves out.
Representative
Kahn and members, we went through House research, and we've been going back and forth the last 2 days about which section of law should be in there. In terms of, can you clarify your question? What it leaves?
Yes. I mean, what candidates? There are lots of candidates on the ballot. What candidates aren't in 204B? So you're right. Putting a limitation in. The original bill was for candidates for public office. You're now putting a limitation on that. Who are you letting out? Who are you not including?
Representative Slough.
Well, if you can see on line 1.8, it clarifies who is currently filed for election to public office. So it's a clarification of that. And then 1.1 and 1.2, it's clarifying that it's for the purpose of campaigning for a candidate, registering voters, or getting out the vote.
Representative Kahn.
That's not my question. My question is, what is the limitation that's posed by the language on 1.9, which instead of saying all public office, is only under section 204B.09.
Representative Slough,
let's have House Research answer that. Yeah, I was going to say, can we ask House Research?
We are going to have House Research answer that question. Representative Kahn.
I'm trying to read it with my buddy here, but we want
and
I'd
like
to
the buddy
know what talking
about. Let's go to House Research.
Thank you.
I can also be your buddy. Section 204B.09 is the section that basically lists the time for when you file an affidavit, and it covers state and local candidates.
Mr. Gang, why don't you explain the change here? I mean, we're specifically, what are we doing with that section of law?
Mr. Chair, so the change is delete all amendment has changed it from Chapter 10A and 211A to a reference to 204B.09. And the point there, I think, my understanding of the intent, it was just to clarify that candidates, the previous reference to 10A and 211A aren't the chapters where you file for candidacy. And so the 204B.09 reference is just to refer to the fact that you have to file an affidavit stating your intent to run for office.
Representative
Chairman, what I'm concerned about, and I can't read fast enough to understand that, is that any elimination of local offices from that restriction? Does it include city, school board, park board, library board, etc.?
Mr. Guerin, can you clarify that?
I think my understanding of the language is that it would cover all candidates. If the committee wanted to make it doubly clear, we could take out that reference and just say who is currently filed for election to public office, if that would clarify it.
I don't know what... I guess I'd feel more comfortable doing that, but I'd also just like the assurance that section, for example, there's a reference to counties. But does county mean any kind of local office?
Mr. Guerin.
But if it's okay to take it out, then I'd be comfortable taking it out, because I know the existing language covers all offices. So if there's no need to have that in, I just assume have it out.
Mr. Guerin, does it clarify by taking that new language out on line 1.9?
Mr. Chair, I think if the committee wanted to take this reference out, you would definitely, all candidates would be included. I think the reference does by itself include all candidates because there's references in 204B.09 throughout the section to town candidates and special candidates. So my understanding of this language is that it would include local candidates.
Well, let's ask the sponsor of the bill and Representative Slawik, what's your preference?
Mr. Chair and members, this is a debate we've been having. We actually had a different chapter of law cited there, which we changed to this chapter. So I am okay if we take that out. I think that would be okay. Do you need me to move that, Mr. Chair?
Well, actually, you can't, but one of us will.
Okay.
So Representative Kahn, do you wish to strike 1.9, the new language under section 204B.09?
I guess I would.
All right. So Representative Kahn moves to strike that language. All those, is there any discussion, first of all, to that? And that is agreeable with the sponsor of the bill.
Yes.
All right. All those in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Any questions? Representative Kahn.
Just, if I may, give a little historical reference. This was the first bill after I was elected. The bill that set up this law was carried by me and by Senator Alan Speer in the Senate, both of us newly elected. The bill was suggested to us by the Republican legislator who had occupied my seat before me because he was being kept out of apartment buildings in the dormitory area. We got, as people discovered, Representative Walsh-Slager, when you have the first bill of the session, it was a very early bill, we got into lots and lots of trouble. And I remember that some of the trouble was from people in my own party. I remember there was a lawyer who was giving me a lot of trouble about free access and closing the door, you know, a person's home is their castle and that kind of thing, and where did that door begin? And I remembered he actually was, people were still into being nice to women at that time, so he called me up and said, he called me up the weekend before and said, I'm quoting these following cases, there are these cases, you can check them out. And so it was Saturday, and I didn't know where he went to get law cases on Saturday, so I called, the person in the other half of my district was Martin Szabo, Speaker of the House, so I called him up and asked him what to do. And he said a simple thing to me, he said, have you counted the votes? And I said, yes, we have two to spare. And he says, if you've counted the votes, you don't have to answer the arguments. So.
Representative Kahn is a history teacher. Can you tell us what decade that was?
Yes, I said it was in the 70s.
I just want to clarify.
Even what Hill, century, I can tell you.
I was afraid of that. I was not going to go that far. But Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I was just, perhaps I missed it, but did we actually vote to adopt the delete all amendment?
No, we have not, and actually what I want to do now is be sure what we're voting on. So, Mr. Gary, can you clarify exactly what we're voting on now?
So this, if we're voting on a delete all amendment, this would be the amendment coded DE2, and we, I believe, have voted to delete the language under section 204B.09 in line 9, with the correction on line 12. Of registering voters, not registering votes.
Right, and Mr. Gehring, the word currently would still then be on 1.9. We're not deleting that.
Correct.
All right. Does staff have that correction so we're clear? Yeah. Well, wait. The only thing we're deleting is the new language on 1.9 under sections 204B.09. That's the only thing we're deleting. So we're just deleting the new language. We are not deleting any current language. Yeah, currently stays. All right.
Correct.
Is everyone clear on what we are voting on? All right. All those in favor then of adopting the delete all amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is now amended almost in the shape that the sponsor wants it. Representative Nelson.
And maybe I'm nitpicking here, but and maybe it doesn't change really anything. I just, when it says it's currently filed, and before it was has filed, having had to use this law to get into the many apartments I have in my district, and still have trouble getting in there, does this mean you have to be after July when you file for election that you really couldn't use this before you filed for office if you were door knocking in April, May, and June, you couldn't use it to get in the apartments?
you, Representative Slough, do you want to answer that, or should we have House Research?
Representative Nelson, Mr. Chair, I would like House Research to address that.
Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, the language is currently filed, was included, I'm understanding the intent, so that it would cut out the potential of some person claiming to have been a candidate in the past and having have filed, you know, 10 years ago and now wanting access to a building.
Mm-hmm.
I guess reading the language, you know, if I'm reading it correctly, I think your question is correct, that you would have to have filed currently.
So would
have,
the
you'd have to have an affidavit on file in order to gain access.
Mr. Chair, the you would be able to get into those buildings till after July 15th or whenever the filing date is around that time.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative House. I don't want to build Representative Slowick's bill totally in the committee, but if that's a concern, we could put a verbal amendment in here that a candidate who is currently filed or the incumbent.
No.
Representative Howes, you have the...
Yes, it is unfair. If you hear comment,
Representative Howes, the buddy system's still working.
Yes, it's still working.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a number of questions, but just getting to this specific point, what I would... see the language doing then is making sure, as I look at the open-endedness of getting out the vote, registering votes, that it would put a time limit in place and allow these folks to have some freedom in their own private residences from people bothering them year-round. So I would suggest that language is good language, and I'd hope that we'd keep it in.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I guess responding to Representative Howes and Representative Broad, I got two remarks here. One is that doesn't mean anyone that has a single family home doesn't have that privilege. They're knocked on, their doors are knocked on 24/7, 365 days a year. But I guess if I was going to change this at all, it would be maybe putting it as a campaign committee filed with the state. But I think we'll just leave it the way it is. I also know the apartment buildings that you're probably not good to go in there anyway till after September anyway, because it's not the people move so much in my district anyway that by September they're kind of set because their kids are in school. Before that they're in and out so much you probably can go to the same apartment five times in the summer and have five different people living there.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Slowick, I'm wondering, is there a definition, and maybe Mr. Gearing, this is the question for you, is there a definition of campaign worker in statute or assigned in the bill? I don't see a definition, and has relevance to my questions.
Representative Slough.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I refer to House Research for that.
Representative, Mr. Gearing.
Mr. Chair, there is not a definition of campaign worker in Chapter 211B.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little concerned about who that opens this up to. You know, can you just say that you're working on behalf of a candidate? Who do you actually make the request to? You know, do you call the private property owner and get entrance that way? Aunt Sue opens the door and lets you in, and therefore you're eligible to knock on all the doors. Or do you have to ask the manager? Do you have to ask the owner? All sorts of things. One of the other issues that I guess I'm wondering about is the buddy system is working here too, because Representative Hilty is helping me out with my questions too. But one of the other things that I'm wondering about is whether Mr. Horner has an opinion on an expansion of liability. You know, who are we letting in to these places, and is there an expansion of liability for the property owner or in some of the cases on a common interest community, things along those lines for those private property owners? I don't know if Mr. Horner, if you have an opinion about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I don't see an expansion of liability. Underlying law does allow a property manager, whether he's managing an apartment or a condominium or an enclosed single-family occupied housing community, which are covered by all of these, does allow them to require an advanced appointment. So if there's any questions about whether somebody really is a legitimate candidate or who it is, there would be an opportunity to at least find out about that. And another question that had come up previously or implied, an individual apartment occupant or condominium occupant is not at all required under this law to let anybody into his home, just like a single-family homeowner is not allowed. But this bill, which we have supported over these decades, it just simply allows a candidate to be able to get into the building itself for purposes of campaign. Some people will do it, as you represented, or as you suggested, Representative Broad. Some will, Mr. Chairman, some will ring a doorbell and somebody lets them in and they're in and out, up and down the halls. But I think candidates are certainly well aware that it's counterproductive to be annoying people and to be doing something that is kind of scary to people. We have not sensed a lot of problem with this. This bill does expand a little bit, and so we do think it important to then also limit, as this bill does a little bit, provide a little bit more clarity as to exactly who and when can enter.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I know there's a couple lawyers on the committee, but it just seems to me that the campaign workers then who are associated with the campaign or with the campaign, if something were to happen, we of course don't want that to happen, but if something were to go wrong and that person would be injured, I'm just wondering if the campaign has any liability for those workers in that situation.
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I just don't know, I'm sorry, to what extent they're agents. I mean, I suppose in a technical way they're agents of the campaign. On the other hand, they're, for the most part, almost exclusively unpaid volunteers. Well, in a word, I don't know.
Representative Wolfschanger, I think, was it?
Chair, members, and maybe this is a question for House Research. It's on 1.15 where it says a candidate and campaign workers. And I'm not a lawyer either, but does this mean that the candidate has to be present? In other words, and I'm looking at the words and or.
Mr. Gary?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schauger, yes, in order for a campaign worker to be allowed admittance to any one of these buildings, they have to be accompanied by a candidate. So a candidate could go by themselves, but a worker could not.
Okay.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative House and Representative Nelson's earlier point about the calendar here, I'm wondering if the open-ended candidate who is currently filed for election might be interpreted to include for state candidates an active campaign committee. And it's just, I guess, a question for House Research and whether we do want to clarify that or even just make that intent clear right now.
Mr. Gearing?
I'd only be speculating on, you know, how people might interpret it. The language says is currently filed for election to public office, so I suppose that could conceivably lead to an interpretation that if you have a campaign committee, that therefore you're filed for election. My understanding of the intent is, though, as we mentioned earlier, is that a candidate would have needed to file an affidavit of candidacy. But since we took out the reference to Section 204B.09, that may make that a bit more ambiguous.
Representative Wolfschanger.
Chair, members, I mean, I have been through contested primary, contested endorsements, etc. All of that occurs before your filing in July. So, and I'm not sure. And when you file a committee, isn't that for the public finance money? I mean, that's not the same thing.
That's
right. Walter, are you asking a question to Mr. Gehring? Or
to House I mean, I am concerned about this. If it's going to be July, I mean, a lot of campaign activities occur before July.
Mr. Gehring, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, you're correct about filing the... You're talking about registering your committee with the Campaign Finance Board. That would come under Chapter 10A. and that deadline is different based on when you receive certain amounts of money or when you spend certain amounts of money. So, like I said, the committee wanted to make it clear that this would apply once you've filed your committee with the campaign finance board. We can make an amendment that would reflect that.
Representative Wolfgang.
Chair members, all I'm trying to get at is I would be opposed to a date, you know, for July forward. That's what I'm trying to get at. I don't know if I'm articulating it right or not, but.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I think Representative Wolfschlager has brought up a good point. I mean, the difference is you have the registering with the campaign finance board, which is different from what this bill is addressing. This is filing with the Secretary of State's office, and that's when you sign the affidavit saying, yes, I want to be on the ballot. But the concern that I have with this portion, and I was hoping Representative Slawick could help me out on this, you file in July with the Secretary of State's office. What happens when your opponent in a primary situation, they're still filed as a candidate, so say they lose, your opponent loses the primary, are they then still allowed to campaign against you? Maybe they hold a grudge because they lost the primary. Are they then still allowed access come October after they've lost the primary?
Representative Slack.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, by this definition, they would need to be the candidate to gain the access. And at that point, because they've lost, they would no longer be a candidate, would be my understanding.
Okay.
Representative
Kahn. Mr. Chairman, I've probably done more of this than anyone else because of the location in my district. And I'm pretty good at holding grudges. But it would take to lose an election and then to go through this process would take even more than I could stomach.
Ripson Kalen, are you still on my list?
Which list is that, Mr. Chair?
Bring it up.
Having raised this question of timing and the open-ended definition again, revisiting it, and thinking through, I think that even in Representative Kahn's district or in Representative Clark's district, where maybe half of the voters are in these situations, I do think that we hear probably quite a bit that our constituents would love if campaigns were 6 or 8 weeks long, and there's plenty of other activity for us to be doing and other direct voter contact for candidates to be doing, and I'm satisfied with the July deadline and just want to make clear that it really is filing for an affidavit for public election. That may be something I'll talk to the author about after, just to sort of ponder to clarify that so we don't leave it open-ended, but people are kind of sick of campaign stuff in general.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, on a separate note, something that Representative Wolfschlager had also mentioned on another line here, I think it's regarding unpaid campaign workers. Are we able to insert that language just to give clarification as to who we're going to allow access?
So, Representative Anderson, can you tell us where you would insert that?
Anytime campaign workers is listed in the new language, perhaps on 1.13 and on line 1.15.
And specifically, what do you wish to insert, Representative Anderson?
The word unpaid. But I don't know how Representative Slawick feels about that.
Well, let's ask Representative Slawick first.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I would be opposed to that. I think it would be very difficult for an apartment owner to know if someone was paid or unpaid. And I think in many cases there are field workers who are paid that for our, you know, how the process works. And if the field worker is assigned to a campaign and it's their job to go into the apartment, I don't see, I think that would be an issue. And again, how would the apartment folks distinguish between who's paid and unpaid? I think for all of us, most of our volunteers are unpaid, but during that particular season, there's a few that are paid.
Representative Anderson.
Well, the reason why I bring it up, to be honest, I think we all have experienced that sometimes people don't even know who the candidate is, so, you know, sometimes I don't know if they're going to be able to verify that the candidate is with these folks either, so I just think it would be give us greater clarification on who we're allowing in. I think it gets at some of the issues that Representative Broad has brought up as far as liability goes, who
Representative, you actually, you didn't make a motion.
No.
It was a suggestion. So there's no motion before us. It's a talking point. Any further discussion on the delete all amendment as amended? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one question, and maybe this will be for staff because of, and, well, Representative Kahn. If a corporation owns a large apartment complex, and this allows us to leave literature behind, if the literature is left in the lobby on a little table or something for people to pick up, would that be somehow not an in-kind donation by a corporation, but a mistakenly contribution by a corporation? And I'm worried about a lot of apartment buildings in all over the state. You can go in, and if you have permission to leave literature, and it doesn't say where, you could lay it on a table right next to the elevator, right next to the stairways, right next to the entrance, rather than at each door. So that means the corporation that owns this apartment building is allowing you to do that. Now, up north, where I live, we can't put signs on Potlatch property because they are a corporation. So, would this apply also to literature?
Representative House, are you asking Representative Kahn? Because she is definitely...
She's shaking her head.
She's unpaid staff. I want to make that clear. and maybe we should go to paid staff on that one.
Well, I was trying to make use of the buddy system, but we're going to tag team.
I'm not sure which of you is Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. I'm going to figure it out.
It's open for discussion.
Let's try paid staff, just for a second. Sure. Mr. Gehring, you want to respond to that one?
Mr. Chair, I can try to respond, although, to be honest, I guess I don't know the answer off the top of my head, if it would be a contribution or not. I think
started out with literature on a table and evolved from that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, in my district, we can't put signs on Potlatch property because they're a corporation unless we pay them. We could pay to have our sign put there. I think this is the same, and if Representative Slawick would just be willing to work with me before we vote for it on the House floor and figure out, and maybe we can say it has to be hung on the doorknob or laid at the bottom of the door of the apartment, and then it wouldn't be a corporate issue or something, just to clarify that.
Well, Representative House, I appreciate that, but it would be, I think, better if we got our work done in committee rather than on the floor. After yesterday, it would definitely be preferable to do it here. So if we're going to have a series of amendments, and we could deal with them today, if not, then I think we'd lay this over and come back and revisit this and clean it up here before we get to it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's my only concern right now with the bill is a clarification of where you leave the literature within that building if it's owned by a corporation.
Representative Kahn.
Well,
speaking as unpaid
staff. Yes. One of the things is the least. First of all, I don't think there would be an issue unless one candidate was given access and another one was not given access to do that. Second of all, that's about the least effective thing that you can do. We found any place that we've gone into, if we've had an argument about access, they said, well, you can just leave it on the table by the mailbox or something like that. That's not what anyone ever wants when they're using this section of the law. That's totally useless, and so I don't think it could ever be considered a contribution of any value.
Mr. Representative Howell.
Chairman, I would have to, on this instance, disagree with the buddy system in that we have restaurants up north where you go in and you'll have brochures about fishing guides and sailboat rides, casinos and stuff like that, and right in there, there are pamphlets from candidates, literature. The restaurant is a corporation. Most of us don't say a lot. Some of us take them out and put them somewhere else. Well, Mr. Chairman, it was not a reference to Representative Kahn.
because I've seen it happen in my district.
Rep Stenhouse, I was wondering when, that's where I thought you were going originally, and I...
No, I was not going there, but when I said it, I realized I had went there, and it's too late to dig out of the hole.
But, and Rep Stenhouse wishes she had neither, either.
I've never
seen
that in a restaurant.
It happens all the time in our district. Mr. Chairman, if staff could just find a way to make me comfortable that the literature left would be either at the door of each apartment or somehow...
Mr. Chair, Representative Howes, one language we had in there yesterday that came out was we had neat and orderly in there, which the Housing Association would like in there, but it came out at a point yesterday. I asked her if that specifically addresses it, but neat and orderly would mean, you know, not left in any manner that's distracting for the residents.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, what if we were to somehow say we could leave the literature, but not in a public area? Now, the hallways of apartments are not public areas, but the lobby is a public area. So that would take away leaving them by the elevator where people could just grab, or it's just a thought. Mr. Chairman, maybe they'll stop thinking for now.
Why don't we have do you have a suggestion, Mr. Gehring, or a clarification? I prefer the clarification rather than the suggestion, but either one.
Mr. Chair, I could, if the committee wanted to adopt this amendment, we could include language that would clarify that any literature left in an apartment building or other building would not be considered a contribution to the candidates committee under Chapter 10A. And we could also clarify language if you wanted to say, if the committee wanted to say campaign materials left, on line 1.16, permit to leave campaign materials for residents who are absent so long as the materials are not left in a public place.
Mr. Chairman, I like the second one a lot better.
All right. Mr. Gehring, how long would it take you to put something together that we could actually see today?
Mr. Chair, I could, I could sort of dictate what I just said, if that's what the committee wanted, okay, or I could write something up.
Why don't you write something up, and then Representative Kahn?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really don't think that we need that. I understand former Hennepin County staff has just informed me that the law says that for a private entity, for you have to allow access to everyone or to no one. So Potlatch, if they wanted to allow everyone to put their signs up, could do that, or they've taken the policy of allowing no one. So it's not. So it's defend how they defend call a public place. But I guess I would object to that.
The former Hennepin County staff, do you want to identify who that is?
Yes.
If they're here, would they like to come down and testify to that effect?
No, he's not. He's not here. Sorry. My committee administrator is former. He was bringing me something, and he said, by the way, this is how the law works. So we could call him. He is in the building. But anyway, the point is, as I said, it is not useful to put a pile of literature on the table. Sometimes it's useful to pin something up on a bulletin board with permission and that kind of thing. You know, I just think this hasn't been an issue in the 35 years that this has been in existence, and I don't think we need to make it an issue now. So I would, it's obviously a possible amendment. I'd vote against
Mr. Gehring has language. Mr. Gehring, why don't you tell us where this goes and read it slowly, and this addresses Representative Howe's concern, I hope. So,
okay. So this proposed amendment would be to say on line 17 after the word them, insert so long as the materials are not left in a public area of the building.
Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with that. And the only reason I bring it up, Mr. Chairman, and I know Representative Kahn doesn't like it, but it's because we've added to the original law. We've added allowing us to leave campaign material. And I just want to clarify that it's not left in a public place.
All right. Representative Nelson.
I guess that gets into the discussion of what's a public place. Is the hallway that all the doors lead to a public place? I'm having dealt with an apartment owner that I had to go to their national headquarters to get permission to get in, and then the manager of that building was still upset about it, and then sent the their maintenance staff around to pull every piece of literature out of every door behind me. I guess the public place is that hallway considered a public place, and so you're leaving it on the door in the hallway, the shared hallway, which is I would consider that a public place. I mean, that gets into definition. I just think it's I think we're going a little too far there, because then you get basically you're negating being able to leave literature if you're hanging it on a door in a shared hallway.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Simon was leaning forward as an
attorney.
He might help
too.
Us with that. But
my list is getting.
I don't believe that a hallway of an apartment building is a public place. It is a common place, and I'm not real up on association or township association laws where. Whether it's a condominium or townhome complex or whatever, but that's a shared space by the residents. It's not a public place. The only public place is the entry area of the building where the elevator might be. That would be a public place.
Representative Broad, you're next. You're next.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might have a different solution for the problem, so I think I'll just defer and
All right.
Let the
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm concerned that this amendment does not clarify the situation. Instead, it makes it more ambiguous. I think, as Mr. Horner testified earlier, it's recognized that when candidates and campaign workers go into apartment buildings or others, we're there to inform, to register voters, and to get out the vote. We're not there to annoy. We're not there to make a mess, because any of that would be, as Mr. Horner said, counterproductive. So I think that the way this amendment is right now is good, and we don't need this clarification, because I don't think it serves that purpose. Thank you.
Right. Representative Simon.
No, I actually hadn't raised my hand, but thank you.
Oh, anyway. All right. Thanks. You somehow got on the list, but that's okay. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think this is a legal problem. There's nothing in the campaign finance statutes that makes them superior in any way to this statute. So if candidates are permitted to leave campaign materials behind in the apartment building, that is a way of defining what a corporate contribution would be in this case. If you're allowed to do it under statute, then that necessarily means that it's not a violation of campaign finance law, because the laws are interpreted to be consistent with each other. So I don't see that there's any campaign finance issue here. There might be an annoyance factor if materials are left all over the place, but the way the law is written, I think it gives some discretion to the property maintenance people in the building and the candidates to make sure that they're working together. And you know, I think the all the reasons stated by Representative Kahn, Morgan, and others indicate that this would be a pretty easy thing to administer. And I don't think that there's a need for any change.
Mr. Chairman, somehow since the amendment that hasn't been offered yet is only a suggestion by staff, I will not offer the amendment.
All right.
I see I might be slightly outnumbered.
Representative Howes, I'm not sure. You never know until you vote. All right. Is there any? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with six brothers, I'm always outnumbered, so that doesn't deter me. But I would like to make an amendment or move an amendment to lines 1.15, change the must to may. I think we've had a pretty significant discussion regarding these materials and making sure that they're neat and orderly, but having a fourth grader, I deal in the world of what ifs quite often, what if you had left your materials neat and orderly and somebody didn't necessarily want them neat and orderly and wanted to give you a black eye, those materials could certainly be shoved around. What if those neat and orderly materials were moved into the center of the hallway and somebody walked by, slipped and fell, you got some liability issues there. So in order to get rid of these what ifs and many others that I can't think of, I think that we should just change it from a must to a may.
Representative Slock, let's hear your...
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I have a fourth grader, too, so I'm used to dealing in what ifs, and I think I can count the votes, I hope, in here, like Representative Kahn. The whole reason this bill is before you is because Senator Pappas had an issue where she was not allowed to leak campaign materials. So by changing the must to a may, it really it doesn't address the reason why we even have the bill here, which is so that when someone says, I'd like to leave some materials, and I say, no, you can't, say, well, you know, by this statute, I am allowed to. So in my mind, it just sort of negates the whole bill.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Slawick, thank you for that. But I don't think it does negate the bill because it clarifies some things regarding who can enter in with the candidate. And whether I agree with or disagree with those things are still in place. All this is doing is dealing with that one little section of the bill. And counting votes is great, but does that mean that you shouldn't offer up suggestions? Does that mean that you shouldn't offer up amendments? I guess I don't think so.
So, Representative, this is you have offered this as an amendment, and this is all right. So we're discussing an amendment, not just a suggestion. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, again, citing what I said earlier about having a gentleman go behind me and pull them all out of the doors, changing that must to may, you might just as well delete the whole 1.15 to 1.17 because you basically that's what you're doing. I think I would speak against the amendment on that matter because changing that from must to may that basically negates that whole section. And I don't think go as far as the Representative Slawick and say it negates the whole bill, but I think that negates the whole section, which is to me the best part of the whole bill.
I'd hate to make the Seifert speech on the nanny state, but as I live life, falling and slipping on loose campaign literature is one of the lowest problems I've ever encountered.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, I mean, then why have that piece at all? I mean, if we're talking about a nanny state, Representative Kahn, it looks like you and I agree on this piece, so I sure hope you're going to support my amendment.
Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the amendment, I think the goal of this statute, the goal of this section of this bill and of the statute as it exists is to provide a level playing field, to make sure that I think, you know, in the Potlatch Corporation situation, that they've chosen to level the playing field by allowing no access, but here to making sure that voters are making informed decisions and that no one candidate is favored over another, and that all voters, regardless of income, have access to information about the choices before them on the ballot. And I think that, you know, we have some concerns here that have been raised that I think delve a little maybe too deeply into the what if. And I think that we just want to make sure that our voters are decently informed and have an opportunity to take a piece and move on and read it, and maybe one out of 100 do, but just that every candidate have access to it, that we don't make this, you know, we don't tilt that playing field in one direction or another.
Any further discussion on the amendment? All right, just for clarification, Representative Broad moves on 1.15 to delete the word must and insert may. To that amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. And now the bill as amended is before us. Any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
I just have a question. Well, actually, I'd like to make a motion here as well. On line 1.16, I'd like to insert a period after residents and then delete who are absent when the candidate and campaign workers call upon them. And the reason for that is, one, sometimes when you're in an apartment complex, people won't answer the door. So you don't even know if they're there or not, or you can get yourself in trouble because then you left the literature and then they said, well, I was here, blah, blah, blah. Sure. The literature and then they said, well, I was here, blah, 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 sure. So forth. So I'd rather have it that line is deleted completely.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Anderson, your idea makes sense. Right now I don't know if I have a very strong opinion about it. I think most of us, when we go into apartments, are just leaving the lid and not door knocking, but just lid dropping. So I guess I am neutral.
Any further discussion to Representative Anderson's amendment? All right. So Representative Anderson moves on 1.16 and 1.17. 1.16. Insert period after residence and then delete the rest of 1.16 and 1.17.
that correct? Representative Hasley. All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion? No further discussion? I'm not even going to ask. All right. Representative Morgan renews his motion that House File 340 as amended be... We haven't adopted it. All right. Then we have to adopt the delete all amendment. Representative Morgan's motion was to adopt amendment DE2 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is amended. So Representative Morgan renews his motion that House File 340 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Slough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your support.
We have... Where did that here we go. I think Representative Peterson, House File 403.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson, if you just wait 1 second, please. Representative Morgan. House File 403.
I'm up again here, yes.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 403, and this one needs to go, there's no finance application, is it?
General Register.
No, General Register.
All right. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here. Hopefully this bill will take a little less time because it's so clear and concise. And this bill is about the use of disclaimers in campaign material. And since April of 2006, that's just 9 months ago, Minnesota now has an unenforceable disclaimer law. I think many of us who ran campaigns didn't even realize that. And, of course, most of us continued to put disclaimers on our material. House File number 403 responds to the decision of the Minnesota Court of Appeals in Riley versus Jankowski with Judge Randy Peterson, who some of us know, handed down a decision in April of 2006 that our Minnesota statute 211B.04, our disclaimer requirement, violates the First Amendment to the Constitution. The court found the statute to be overly broad, regulating pure speech, even truthful speech, unsupported by any compelling governmental interest, such as the government's interest in avoiding the appearance of corruption. Judge Peterson's decision was based on a 1995 Supreme Court ruling in an Ohio case. In that case, Justice Stevens, writing for the 7-person majority, recognized that a state's enforcement interest might justify a more limited identification requirement and held that the Ohio law went too far. Now, the bill that you have before you today adds language to the Minnesota law, which we believe will address the concerns of Judge Peterson in his court decision last April. So let's review the bill. First of all, Section 1 adds to the disclaimer law statement four purposes that it's designed to serve. It also exempts from the disclaimer requirement individuals or associations that act independently of a candidate, candidate's committee, or political fund, and that spend the individual's or association's own resources on campaign materials, so long as the materials do not violate the false political and campaign material prohibitions in Section 211B.06. Section 211B.06, Minnesota statutes, deals with false political and campaign material. And it states, that if you're guilty of a gross misdemeanor, if you intentionally participate in the dissemination of false political and campaign material. In other words, it exempts you if you're making an independent expenditure and telling the truth. Section 2 makes the act effective the day following final enactment. Let me add that this bill is the best efforts of our research staff to construct additional language in our state law that addresses the concerns of Judge Peterson in his court decision. They have read the findings, our staff, and they've addressed the concerns in the language that you've seen before you. This bill would continue to make candidates responsible for disclaimers on their materials, and it would give independent expenditures a reason to add disclaimers. I believe that most of us who run for office feel the need for disclaimers on our material, and indeed most of us probably operated on that basis as we ran our campaigns, because we thought that it was necessary and probably agreed with the four reasons that were stated in the preface of this this bill. Do you want disclaimers on materials? If so, this language offers us a chance to have a law in Minnesota that provides for free and fair elections, and I think would withstand any future challenges that might be made for this law. So I urge your support of this bill.
Questions? Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, thank you for bringing this forward. I think we do want to make sure that elections are fair and that information is disclosed. Mm-hmm. My big concern with your bill is that it doesn't do that. It does it for a portion of the people out there, but it does not create what in the findings are intended to create, which is a sense of promotion of justice and fair play in campaigns. And I think what I've heard is a level playing field. And so I'm wondering if you can comment about, the sense that we're trying to set up a level playing field, but in reality, that's not what's happening.
Can you be Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, can you be more specific about the level playing field and what you see in this bill that you find missing?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Peterson, I look on lines 2.16, and the section does not apply to objects stating the candidate's name. This is a very tiny piece, or personal letters being sent out by the candidate. I wonder, that's current law, but I wonder why that's the case. And then there's a huge loophole in lines 2.24. When you look at the dollars that are being spent in campaigns, we have campaign finance limits that most of our candidates abide by. The money that's being spent in the campaigns is coming from these exact groups that are being excluded in your bill. They're coming from independent expenditures, they're coming from 527s, and so to say that we have a level playing field, to say that we have disclosure yet excluding those groups, it just seems a little off to me.
Representative Broad, I agree with you. However, I agree with the premise that independent expenditures also should have disclaimers, and that is something that is of concern. However, if you go back to the Supreme Court cases, both in Ohio and with Judge Peterson, those are the issues that came before them, and they felt were ruled unconstitutional. So this bill simply is trying to put back in play our current law by adding this language, the language that you see underlined, and I wish that it also include or could include independent expenditures, but that is not the way the law is written, and currently no one would have to have a disclaimer.
Mr. Chairman, and then Representative Peterson, then I would suggest that we alter the findings or purpose of these requirements, because I think we're setting up a false sense of security, a false sense of fair play by having the findings that are set forth in the bill to promote justice and fair play. But really, we should say, but only for these people that this covers. I'm concerned about the false sense that we're setting up in regards to fair play in our elections, because there's a lot of people acting in our elections that are not covered by this. For example, there was just something in the legal ledger talking about mega donors receiving mixed results in the recent election. Now the key to this is the mega donors and are excluded in your legislation. They come in, spend $4 million, $5 million, and it's both parties, $4 million, $5 million, $10 million, and in our races, $100,000, $300,000, whatever that is. They're spending their money, and to exclude them and to just ignore that piece of a significant part of our campaign finance situation here in Minnesota, I think sets up a false sense for the people in terms of their understanding about what's going on in the campaigns in the state of Minnesota.
Members,
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, this deals only with disclaimers. It does not deal with campaign contributions. And, you know, the limits and contributions could be handled in another bill and perhaps are being handled in another bill. This strictly deals with disclaimers and the need to have disclaimers to say who is producing the materials, who is putting those materials forth to the public, and it does give us some guidelines, and that is all that this bill is intended to do. And it has been written by our staff with the idea that this might withstand a court challenge, and I think it deserves a chance at least to be put forward and have at least the current law that we have in place and functioning so that we know that we have some disclaimers to know who is producing material.
Representative Broad, one more and then
Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm very clear on what the bill does, but I'm also very clear on what the bill does not do, and that's what I'm pointing out. I'm not talking about limits. I'm not talking about caps. That's a whole separate discussion. What I'm talking about is the huge loophole that is in this bill that allows people that are talked about in this article, the super rich, they say, an architect, John Stryker, whatever, you can add your own name in there, weighing in on our elections with no disclaimer requirements and having impacts one way or another. That's what I'm talking about is the loophole. I understand the difference between the two.
Okay. Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pearson, let's just go to Representative Stein. We're running out of time here, and
okay.
Unless you're recognized, you really shouldn't speak.
I'm sorry. I thought you recognized me.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Quickly, Mr. Chair. First of all, I think there is a distinction to be made here. We tackled the issue of the money, or we purported to do so, last week when we took up Representative Morgan's bill. That's the issue of the money. And that, so far as I know, is not an unconstitutional restriction to say that when you give money, you have to report it within a certain time frame. That issue we've already taken up. This issue has to do with what you do once you get the money, once you disseminate materials. So the money question is separate, and we tackled that last week. This is about what you do afterwards. Now, I actually agree with Representative Broad and with Representative Peterson in terms of the policy. I would like to see all these groups covered, but the U.S. Supreme Court 12 years ago said you can't do that. And in the McIntyre case, which dealt with an anonymous pamphleteer in Ohio, they said in the tradition of the United States dating back to Thomas Paine, we want to protect that anyone, any crackpot can go out in this country and go to Kinko's and print something out and disseminate it anywhere he or she chooses, and the First Amendment protects that. And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. So following that precedent and others, I would assume, I haven't read the case, but the Minnesota Court of Appeals has said apparently that, you know, because of that U.S. Supreme Court case, you can't do that either. And so I share your frustration as a matter of policy, Representative Broad, but the U.S. Supreme Court has said we can't do that. It's unconstitutional, and that our traditions command us to allow anonymous pamphleteers.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to point out that the things that are put in on 2.225 probably covers most of the independent expenditures that we've seen. Most of them are done by political committees or political funds. So I think, you know, I think they've done a good job in writing this within the limits of the case.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I do appreciate the fact that you're trying to get at the whole issue of fraudulent and false campaign literature being put out there. But the problem is we're operating under parameters that don't allow us to get really at the heart of the matter, and that's the issue of these independent expenditures that come from groups, whether it's the 527, whether it's your own political party, or just an individual acting on their own. And without them having disclaimers, we really aren't solving the problem of having clean and fair campaigns. Because it's not because of this. I think that all of us around this room would say it's not us that are putting out these false materials. It is these other groups that, though they mean well, aren't necessarily helping the political process at all. And I feel that considering what limits we have on ourselves, we really can't solve this problem. It's in the court's hands. They've already said we can't limit these things. And I don't want people to operate thinking that they're doing good government by, you know, supporting something like this when they're really not solving the problem at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I would agree with you. We're not really, we're adding some parameters to the independent expenditures, but right now we have a law that's not even enforceable for our candidates. By adding this, we at least have this piece, the rest of the law, in place so that candidates have to do disclaimers. And I think that's important. Right now we have nothing. Nothing that is enforceable. But by adding this, then we have a new law in place from this session that will allow all the rest of this to be in place so that at least, as it says, most of the participants in campaigns will have to use disclaimers. You're right. We don't get at independent expenditures.
And to Representative Peterson's point, Mr. Gehring, if this law does not pass, then does anybody who's running for office have to have a disclaimer? I mean, if we don't pass this law, we can put out our literature and there, we don't need a disclaimer. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Currently, Section 211B.04 is unenforceable because it has been declared unconstitutional.
All right. So, that Representative Peterson, the intent then of this is at least to go back to where we were, that it, the materials we're putting out, another candidate should have a disclaimer.
Right.
All right. Representative Brown.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Peterson, I would agree with doing that. My concern, again, is the loophole and what we're setting up. So I would move to strike the pieces of the findings, because if we're going to set up an assumption that we're creating a fair playing field, a level playing field, and fairness and justice in our elections, and then don't do it, In the language following, I would suggest that we should take that piece out and just do what you're intending to do, which is deal with our elections, which, if that's the only thing we can deal with, then that's what we should be doing. I would...
Representative Brad, you're moving into strike section one?
Correct.
And this is a motion?
Correct.
Representative Brad has put a motion, so... Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I...
All right, Representative Brown, let's be clear here. You're moving to strike lines 1.6 through 1.22. Is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It's a section one, subdivision one. Thank you for that clarity.
All right. I'm sorry. So it's lines. Mr. Gehring, tell us what she's doing.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is she wants to delete lines 1.8 to 1.22.
And Representative Brad, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So for clarification for staff, that is now the motion before the body. So Representative Olson, is it to this? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brad, if I understand correctly, I mean, this would gut the bill, if I understand correctly. And the reason for these purposes is to try to make our law constitutional. And we need to clarify some of these purposes. So that's why I believe it would gut the bill. But to that point, because I concur with you, Representative Broad, with regard to the concern of purpose number one and purpose number two. And I would like to, I would like to see that we keep purpose number three and number four, because I think they actually have some credibility. Purpose number two is written better in purpose number four. Purpose number four makes more sense than purpose number two, and they're really redundant. They're really repetitive.
Representative Olson, I'm going to ask Mr. Gehring to clarify what you just said. By adopting Representative Broad's amendment, does it indeed get the bill, or if I'm looking on page two, and I'm looking at the new language from lines 2.24 to 2.27, can you clarify for us if Representative Broad's amendment would prevail, would we still have a law that would require disclaimers?
Mr. Chair, the question about whether this would gut the bill, there's still the new language in the new paragraph G from 2.24 to 2.27, so there's still pieces of the bill that would remain. As far as taking out the purposes, if the purposes were removed from this section, it's still... if it were to be challenged in a court, the court would still, you know, look at it and determine whether it's constitutional or not. So by passing this bill without the purpose sections, you're still reaffirming the disclaimer requirements. And so until the law were to be challenged again, the disclaimers would be enforceable.
So Rep. Semples, the point is that if it would pass with the Broad Amendment, we would still have a law in effect that would require disclaimers. That's to your point.
Mr. Chair.
Because you're saying it did not, but the Broad Amendment does not remove the fact that if this law passes, disclaimers would still be required. She's simply removing what would be purpose language.
But my question, Mr. Chair,
the
reason I'm stating I wasn't sure, so it's a good discussion. The reason I thought that it would kind of gut the bill is I thought in order to meet the issues established by the court ruling is we needed to identify some reasons for this law, and the purpose section is removing that. That's what I thought. It's not clear to me why lines 24 through 28 are there and whether or not they're there for addressing the issues raised by that court ruling.
Mr. Gehring, explain to us, would you, why lines 24 through 28 are there?
Mr. Chair, lines 2.24 to 2.28 are there as the substantive attempt to limit the scope of disclaimer requirements so that people making independent expenditures with their own money don't have to incorporate a disclaimer within their material. The purpose statements can be there or not, and the court, if it were to be challenged, could use these purposes or not as it chooses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the point we've just been discussing, there are two sides to the test, the legal test. One is that there has to be a compelling governmental purpose for enacting the law, and the other is that it has to be narrowly tailored, because you're dealing with First Amendment restriction. So by taking out the disclaimers, you are essentially leaving the first part of the test, the compelling government purpose, out of the statute. And I think it would be just as problematic as not having it narrowly tailored as is set forth in subsection G. And so you're right. We can't fix all of the problems with the campaign finance laws through this bill, but I would applaud Representative Peterson for at least trying to keep in place what we've operated under for some time. And the expectations of the public regarding the fairness of elections, I doubt that we're going to be moving that expectation up very high by having these purposes stated at the beginning of the bill. And if anything, they will point to the fact that the Supreme Court has limited the ability of states and Congress to pass legislation that would actually effectively deal with this. So the possible outcome is that there's a giant groundswell of public support for these kind of restrictions that just overwhelms the objections of the Supreme Court. But I think both situations are pretty unlikely.
All right. Members, remember, to the Broad Amendment now, not to the bill, but to the Broad Amendment. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the amendment, the three words that stick out for me are in the preamble, the purpose declaration, are on line 17 of page 1, confront the accuser. And in my county, we had a county commissioner, two county commissioners, one running for re-election to the county board, the other running for the state senate. An anonymous letter was dropped about 3 weeks before, and the aftermath of that is there was no ability, because there was no disclaimer, to confront the accuser. And the aftermath of that is possible litigation that's being prepared. There's no real opportunity to confront the libelous accusations made within that letter. And it's a real issue. It's a real problem. It's actually a pattern of behavior in my community and others. So I place a high value on confronting the accuser. And I do agree that given the holdings of our court and the challenges, that we can't fully accomplish what the preamble sets out to do because of the limitations of the rulings. Yet I believe it's important for us to declare our intent in doing so and to do what we can to get there. And I do hope that Representative Broad, you and I can talk about ways that we might be able to find some real legal expertise to craft that solution so everyone can confront their accusers, so we can have open and fair dialogue. But I would like to leave it in so that we can continue to challenge ourselves to get closer and closer to achieving the objective we set out.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, I have been listening, and I think that there might be a way to make this work better to leave some of the findings in while not setting up a false sense of government purpose. I don't want to set up that sense for our people that we're doing something that we're not. So, Mr. Chairman, I would amend my motion to delete...
Why don't you just withdraw your first one and offer another one?
Fair enough. Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my initial amendment.
All right.
Motion, and I move that we delete subdivision one. Everything after requirement down through lines 1.18 through of. We would then need to capitalize the. And then, Mr. Chairman, the second I think thing we would need to do is on lines 1.20, replace fourth with second purpose.
Mr. Gehring, do you have that? And then can you give it back to us?
Okay. So, Representative Broad, my understanding is that starting on line 1.8, you delete everything after the. So the legislature finds, there's everything after the period. So from the legislature finds, and then on through the range of line 1.8 through line 1.17, delete all of that. Line 1.18, delete a third purpose of, and line 1.20, replace fourth with second. Is that correct?
Representative Brown, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Kalin.
Just a quick suggestion, Representative Brown, a friendly amendment, if we could. To make it cleaner, perhaps just say one purpose, starting at 1.18, one purpose of the disclaimer requirement, and then skipping to 1.20, a second purpose.
Representative Brown.
I view that as friendly.
All right. And Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, we've had a lot of discussion about amendments we haven't heard from the author for quite some time.
We're going to work back
kind
toward
of interested
that.
In hearing.
Yes, I agree. Thank you. Thank you for that. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, actually, you know, there's some discussion about how effective these initial statements would be, and I'm very pleased that the last two were left, because I think particularly lines 1.20 do have the reference to 211B, which I think is important, and so those two pieces are important, I think, and you've chosen the best two to remain, and I'm fine with that.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Is staff clear on this amendment? Members don't look terribly clear.
Could you just actually read?
Yes. Let's go one more time with the amendment from the beginning. Or read what's left. Either way. might be easier. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to read what's left. Mr. Chair, with this amendment... Subdivision 1 would read, Subdivision 1, Purpose of Disclaimer Requirement. One purpose of the disclaimer requirement is to give voters information about the source of statements and campaign materials so they may better judge its credibility. A second purpose of the disclaimer requirement is to make it possible to hold those who disseminate false campaign material in violation of 211B.06 accountable for their actions.
Representative Pat.
I'd like to speak in opposition to the amendment. I think the bill is better the way it stands. I agree with the author that the two most important parts are left, but I think it was better the way we started.
And we've heard from the author. Representative Peterson?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I had my brothers, I'd say yes, the way I have it. The first is the best, but I mean, depending on what this body thinks, and maybe we should ask if our staff feels strongly that, you know, I know that the staff who put this together felt that this met the measure of the law and it did help, but it's up to this group to determine if they think it's necessary.
Well, Representative Peterson, I don't think at this point it's fair to put staff on the line for a position. They act in our direction, and except for one unpaid staff in the corner. Very difficult to control. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear then, Representative Peterson, you were for it before you were against it.
Representative Olson, briefly, because we're running now up to the limit here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much support the amendment, and to Representative Kahn's concern to this, I'll offer my suggestion now. It's not an amendment, but I think we all are frustrated with, at times in our campaigns, with the independent expenditures and taking big hits and no disclaimers and no way to hold people accountable. And my suggestion was, because I think this would address the reasons why Representative Kahn may want to remove this language, is to, after the disclaimer, include with it this language, and this is just a suggestion that if we like, we could do later. If you find campaign material that does not provide this disclaimer, its credibility should be questioned and the material discarded.
Thank you, Representative Olson. All right.
Okay.
Is there any further discussion to the broad amendment? Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Division.
All those in favor of the amendment, please raise their hand. Five. All right. All those opposed? Seeing five in favor and ten opposed, the motion does not prevail. The bill is now before us. We're running really on a time limit here. We have another committee coming in, and they're probably not pleased. So any further discussion at this point? Representative Morgan then renews his motion that House File 403 be recommended to pass as amended. Well, wait. What? No, we didn't amend it. We did not amend it. House File 403 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. And with that, members, meeting is adjourned.